Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Inside the Issue. Today we focus on the management of biliary tract cancers. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Lipiko Goyal from the Stanford University School of Medicine in Palo Alto, California, and Dr. Malin Javli from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. We also have several other investigators who participated in a survey that we're going to show you of their usual treatment practices. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we always do, there's a one-minute pre-meeting and post-meeting survey in the chat room for you to take. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this experience. Well, we're getting all warmed up to head out to San Antonio next week. We hope if you're there, you'll join us for these three symposiums that we'll have starting on a Tuesday night, both in San Antonio, and also we'll be broadcasting this virtually, so you can check it out online. We talk about ER-positive metastatic disease on Tuesday, on Wednesday, localized HER2-negative disease, and Thursday, HER2-low breast cancer, the entire symposium. There's so much to talk about. And then on Friday, we're starting out 7 early in the morning, at least Eastern time. We'll be out in San Diego if you're out there. We're doing 4 programs there on lymphomas, so CLL and multiple myeloma. Fantastic faculties. We're working with more than 50 investigators next week. Always a pleasure. And speaking of a pleasure, I'm really looking forward to inviting you all back to Miami. As we were doing before the pandemic, we're going to spend the entire weekend next March, going through all kinds of cancers with more than 25 clinical investigators. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars and programs. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Kelly on biliary tract cancers, which is what we're going to focus on today. I'm really, I met with each of the faculty separately in the last couple weeks. Just a reminder that we will be talking about an out-of-indication use of therapies today. But I met with the faculty in the last couple weeks to record their presentations, which are very comprehensive. Lippy did a presentation focusing on first-line therapy and then some targeted therapy. And Melinda did a great job reviewing HER2 disease and a number of other topics. Really check it out. They're in the chat room, and when we distribute this program, we'll be sending these out. Here are the papers in these two comprehensive presentations. We just picked out a few of the slides from the faculty, as well as the slides from the survey that we're going to focus on this evening, but really suggest you sort of check it out. Here's where we're heading. We're going to start out with a little bit of an overview of this disease. I don't know if we should say disease or diseases. And then we'll talk about first-line systemic therapy, particularly the issue of IO plus chemo. And then, you know, we've been saying for the last few years that biliary tract cancers are the new small cell. We're going to talk about targeted therapy, and there's lots to talk about there, including targeting with HER2 and ADCs and other HER strategies. But to begin, let's just provide a little bit of an overview. And Malin, maybe you can just talk a little bit about, you know, as I mentioned, I think people, sorry, we can talk about biliary tract cancers, but there are a number of components there. Can you kind of, you know, sort of go through what you go through with your first year fellows in terms of sort of an overview of where you see the disease and how it manifests?
So strangely enough, Neil, even the anatomy of the disease has evolved, or the way we use it in practice. When I trained, we used to call masses in the liver with a certain profile as cancers unknown primary in the liver. Now, we know that these are all often cancers of the small bile ducts above the bifurcation, and cholangiocarcinoma, of them are intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. Now, it's almost 100 years since Dr. Klatskin described a tumor at the junction of the bile ducts, or the common of the hepatic ducts at Yale, that is now called as perihilar cholangiocarcinoma. Other terms are hilar cholangiocarcinoma, Klatskin tumor. And then you have gallbladder cancer, which is, of course, a completely different entity. Not to be confused is just distal cholangiocarcinoma below the bifurcation, which often looks like pancreas cancer because the distal bile duct is within the pancreas. So we tend to group all of these into one entity, but as you said, they're actually different diseases with different anatomical, epidemiological, genetic, and certainly clinical pictures.
So, Lippy, I'm curious, you know, we had a couple cases presented of so-called mixed HCC and biliary tract cancer. Can you comment on sort of your vision of what's going on there and how you treat those patients?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's why we always encourage biopsies for anyone with advanced disease. With even if radiologically we think they might have HCC, every once in a while when you biopsy, you find out that they actually have a mixed tumor or these collision tumors where they have some cells that look like an adenocarcinoma and it's cholangiocarcinoma, and some cells that look like hepatocellular carcinoma. You know, for a long time, we often used to treat the adenocarcinoma component with gemcitabine cisplatin because all we had was sorafenib for HCC. But now that we have effective frontline treatments for both diseases, we often look at what is the dominant component of that cancer and we'll treat in that way.
So one of the things that you went through with me, Melinda, was issues related to the incidence. First, I thought the geographic incidence of the disease is really interesting. Any comments on that? And then you also talked about the increasing incidence and maybe the tie-in to obesity or even, I don't know, NASH, as we've seen with HCC. Any comments on what's going on epidemiologically, Milind?
So the epidemiology of the study, the classic teaching is that these are diseases that are more common in the Asian continent, mostly in East Asia, associated with hepatitis and liver fluke infection. Now, we know that this pattern is evolving, and particularly intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, which used to be rare, is constituting majority of the patients that we see in a medical oncology hepatobiliary clinic. And we believe that has a lot to do with lifestyle issues, with obesity and fatty liver, hepatitis, substance abuse, and so on. So this is unfortunately a disease, intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, that is increasing and is going to continue to increase. So as you can see, I'm in Texas, and in Texas we are burdened with the highest incidence of primary liver cancer in the country, and that is no doubt related to sometimes some of these lifestyle issues that I mentioned. In really large, we looked at the city of Houston, where the proportion was much higher than expected in any metros this age, metros of this size. So there are certain factors that might lead to this, and a very talented epidemiologist at MD Anderson, Dr. Hassan, she looked at patients who had cholangiocarcinoma and basically tracked their lifestyle and their weight, body weight, and so on over years, and found that early onset obesity that is occurring in the second and third decade of life was particularly a high risk for young patients with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, higher than what we see with, for instance, primary sclerosing cholangitis, which is an important risk factor in young patients with cholangio. So there are lots of patients being diagnosed with fatty liver, with NASH. I returned from India from a cholangio trip, Lippy and I, just 2 weeks ago. There we saw patients with the same issues that we see in the West, rising incidence of obesity, fatty liver, NAFLD, and cholangio, intrahepatic cholangio.
Lippy, I never really understood why you see HCC with NASH. You know, I'm curious, any thoughts about the pathophysiology of, you know, what the potential connection would be between, you know, for example, obesity and these diseases?
Yeah, you know, anytime we see chronic inflammation in the liver, we're seeing that there's an increased risk of cholangiocarcinoma and HCC. So primary sclerosing cholangitis, inflammation of the bile ducts, you know, hepatitis C also caused a fair amount of inflammation in the hepatocytes, you know. So I think part of it in terms of NAFLD, and now it has a new name with metabolic, it's inflammation related.
So I want to ask you also, in your presentations, both of you presented some cases, and Lippy, you presented a case to me of a patient who had hypercalcemia and commented that it was not uncommon to see that, which was sort of news to me. Maybe I missed that day in med school. But actually, you actually have a recent paper in JAMA Oncology 23 focused on this. What do we know about hypercalcemia and cholangio?
Yeah, we wanted to raise awareness about this because in practice, when you see a lot of cholangiocarcinoma, we were noticing that we're seeing a fair number of patients that develop hypercalcemia, and many of them even in the absence of bone metastases. And we looked in the literature and we found there were certainly case reports of patients with cholangiocarcinoma or small case series, but we wanted to do a large study looking at patients with cholangiocarcinoma. And what we found by looking at nearly 400 patients was that at the time of diagnosis, 11% of patients have hypercalcemia. These are patients with advanced disease. But if you look at any time during the course of their disease, 31% of patients with cholangiocarcinoma have hypercalcemia. And specifically in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, it was 37%. And one of the things we noticed was, you know, in all of these diseases of the GI tract, the cancers of the GI tract, a lot of people have hypoalbuminemia. And so if you just look at the electronic medical record, the calcium, serum calcium looks normal because it's not actually correcting for the low albumin level. So we specifically looked at, if you look at rates of hypercalcemia with a corrected calcium, so taking the albumin into account, then the rate is higher. So it's an under-recognized complication of cholangiocarcinoma. So one of the calls we made in the discussion of our paper was the electronic medical records should start putting in red the corrected calcium so that people are more aware of hypercalcemia associated with malignancy.
That's really a great point. Any comments on this, Milind? And also, what's the pathophysiology? Is it like bone mets or paraneoplastic PTH? What do you think is going on?
So you do see bone mets at a higher frequency in certain types of cholangio, for instance, FGFR-associated cholangio. But Lippi is absolutely right. Majority of them do not have it. So do not have bone mets. So we suspect it's a paraneoplastic, probably a hormonal mechanism and something more than, you know, just from the bone itself.
So Lippi, this is a slide from your presentation summarizing some of the developments in the field. Maybe you can, I'm curious from both of you, I think we just started to see approvals in biliary tract cancers in the last couple of years, and now there's been a bunch of them. You can see the right side of this graph has got a lot of stuff on it. Can you kind of provide an overview of what's been going on in the field, Lippi?
Sure. I remember when I was doing my fellowship, I did my senior seminar on ABC02, the gemcitabine cisplatin trial, and that is all we had for cholangiocarcinoma. And I remember as a fellow just seeing so many patients die within 6 to 12 months of being diagnosed with this disease. And it's been heartening to see the community of doctors and all different kinds of clinicians, pharma companies, biotechs, patient advocates, all coming together to work on developing more treatments for this disease. And what we've seen over the last 10 years is all these bubbles, all these new FDA approvals for cholangiocarcinoma. The first drug ever approved into cholangiocarcinoma was in 2020, and it was an FGFR inhibitor. And since then, we've had multiple approvals.
So I want to say, Neil, this brings a story. When I was the first year attending at Roswell Park in Buffalo, my fellow was Francisco Hernandez, who's a lymphoma doctor over there. And when I made a presentation on biliary cancer, he said, based on what you tell me, anybody with biliary cancer, this was the mid-90s, should go on a phase one trial because there's nothing for them to do, nothing that we can offer. And so, as Lippi said, this is such a transformative experience that we are proud to be witnessing over the last particularly 5 years.
So, Lippi, you came up with this bucket concept that I really like a lot, thinking about the types of therapies that have been developed in the disease. And obviously, we're going to go through a lot of these today. And again, the presentations are all kinds of stuff really interesting. MDM2, super cool things there. Can you, again, kind of provide a little bit of an overview of some of the types of therapies? I mean, the title of this thing is Targeted Therapy and Immunotherapy, like it is for oncology in general. Can you comment?
Sure. You know, for a long time, what we had was chemotherapy, and we were glad chemotherapy had some efficacy in biliary tract cancer. But then over time, these drugs that have been working in other cancers, we've brought them to biliary tract cancer, and we've now noticed multiple different therapies in the targeted therapy bucket and in the immunotherapy bucket are having efficacy. And so in targeted therapy, we'll talk today about FGFR inhibitors, IDH1 inhibitors, BRAF inhibitors, and HER2 inhibitors. And then there are also some rare but important targets like NTRK fusions, RET fusions, MDM2 amplification, and in 1% to 2% of patients, KRAS G12C mutations. And then for immunotherapy, you know, there was a tissue agnostic approval of pembrolizumab for MSI high tumors several years ago. But now there's a biliary specific approval for two different immunotherapy agents, durvalumab and pembrolizumab. These are in the frontline setting in combination with gemcitabine and cisplatin. So either gemcitabine, cisplatin, durvalumab, or gemcitabine, cisplatin, pembrolizumab. And I know Milind will talk a little bit more about these two exciting trials that led to FDA approvals of these immunotherapies.
So Milind, this slide is fascinating and also somewhat disconcerting to me in terms of the real world, so to speak, what happens with these patients and how few of them make it to second and particularly third line therapy. This is really a great paper too, incidentally, or presentation. Can you kind of provide an overview of what's really going on? A lot of these patients didn't even get first line therapy, not a lot, but you know, some, I think 15%.
So this was a survey that done by some of the large tech, from some of the large Texas practices. And I'm going to commend my fellow Madhu Eluri for doing this. So 15% of patients who actually made it to this practice, so who had good insurance, never even got treated. In fact, there's a paper from Holland where the number seems to be very alarmingly high, almost 50% where in Europe where they didn't get treated. I think the number is somewhere in between where patients don't get treated because their PS is too poor or their bilirubin is too high or whatever. And out of the people who get treated first line, you have only about 40% of patients end up getting second line, and then 17% of patients end up getting third line. Whereas you see these trials where the median progression of free survival is 6 to 8 months, etc. In the real world setting, patients do not have this performance status of 1, perfect labs, etc. So the median duration of therapy in the first line is somewhere between 3 and 4 months, and even shorter in the second and third line setting. Some of the fainter lines that you see are the pink and the chrome streaks are the people who get the targeted therapies and some of the novel treatments that we are going to talk about. So while there have been very exciting developments, this remains an area of great unmet need.
All right, well, let's get into, I'm already seeing questions in the chat room about chemo IO, you went through this, Milind, the more recent Pembro study combined with GemSys, the Keynote 966 study, very similar findings, I think, to the Durva study that had previously reported, GemSys durvalumab. Any comments in general about the results? When you look at these two trials, Milind, is there any way to separate it as a sort of a coin toss? Are there differences in the way they approached it? There's a question in the chat room from Abdul who says that he's finding a lot of people who get the Topaz 1 regimen of just GemSys Durva relapse when the chemo is stopped. Any thoughts about maintenance and also choice of therapy, Milind?
Yes, so these are similar studies, but they're not the same. So you have pembrolizumab and durvalumab. In the pembrolizumab study, the GemSys and Pembro was given for 6 months, after which gemcitabine and Pembro were given in the treatment arm versus gemcitabine alone in the control arm. So people did get sort of chemo light, if you may, along with pembrolizumab. In the GemSys and the Durva study, the treatment arm after 6 months of GemSys and Durva was Durva alone as a maintenance, and then GemSys plus placebo, that was placebo alone. So there were some differences in between the two arms. I think Abdul is absolutely right. The curves sort of are similar when you go to about 6 months, and they tend to separate. There are people who relapse right after or progress right after you stop the chemotherapy. And I think we are learning, even in practice, If there are situations where you need to continue chemotherapy after 6 months, I think it's going to be a close call. There are certain situations where it might be prudent to continue. But both studies showed that at the end of 2 years, a quarter of those patients, around 25% of patients, have the disease controlled with immunotherapy. So this is a definite gain. Although the median survival improvement was modest, less than 2 months, when you look at it, there's a tail in the curve, especially at 2 years, and this tail in the curve justifies the use of immunotherapy in these patients.
So, Lippy, I'm curious about, because Milan made that comment to me when he was doing the presentation, and I was thinking about the fact that, you know, globally overall, the results aren't that spectacular. But if there is that tail that he just talked about, that kind of changes the way you see things. And I think a lot of times in oncology, that's the hope when you give an IO that, you know, lung cancer, we have the most data, I think, in terms of longer term, you know, 5-year outcomes. But I guess it's kind of harder with less patients to be clear. But from your point of view, Lippy, do you see long-term survivors who are getting IOs?
Yeah, certainly. You know, as Milan was mentioning, that the 2-year survival is around 25% when you give the combination triplet therapy. And so we're hoping to be able to develop biomarkers to identify who are the people in that part of the curve so that, you know, we have a couple of different regimens that we can give frontline. You know, one of the other regimens we'll talk about, the trial led by Dr. Schroff, SWOG-1815, gemcitabine, cisplatin plus nab-paclitaxel, as a frontline regimen. In that study, we found that patients with gallbladder cancer did particularly well, and patients with locally advanced cancer did particularly well. So wouldn't it be great if we could identify who should be getting gemcitabine, cisplatin, nab-paclitaxel up front versus gemcitabine, cisplatin, IO up front?
And Abdul in the chat room comes back and asks about what do you do with after failure of durva first line, and what about the possibility of keeping immunotherapy going and switching the chemo? And that kind of leads us to the survey, because that's actually one of the survey respondents actually suggested that, maybe just to be controversial. Dr. Abu Alfa always likes to sort of, you know, pick things to get people to think. And you can see that he actually brings up this possibility. But let's just talk about first-line therapy first, Milan. First of all, at least from the efficacy point of view or any other point of view, any way to separate out Pembro or Durva, or is it sort of a coin flip, what you're used to type thing?
I think I agree with, for instance, Lippy, who has mentioned here that you can use both regimens. I think they're perfectly appropriate to use both. Durva has been approved, you know, so we have about a year and a half experience with it. That sort of is one reason why we use it. But I think it's perfectly fine to use either regimen in the first line setting.
So, and then the other thing we were curious about is we presented an 80-year-old patient. You're going to see us do this with a number of these scenarios. People pretty much gave the same answers. But Lippy, I'm curious, and I'm thinking a little bit about what Melinda was saying about people not getting treated, even if they're in an oncology practice. Of course, some patients certainly have the right not to be treated. But how would you approach a 92-year-old who was frail and comorbid but wanted to be treated?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we did a study in collaboration with Milland and several other centers around the country looking at older patients versus younger patients with cholangiocarcinoma. And we specifically looked at 50 as a cutoff. And we found something similar to Milland. Milland was saying 84% of patients overall got treatment. We found that in patients over the age of 50, it was 70% of patients got any treatment at all for advanced disease, compared to about 96% of patients under the age of 50. And only 40% of patients went on to get second line treatment. And so I think that helps us think about decisions around, if we only have one shot with many patients, how are we going to use that one shot? And so if I have an older patient and they want to do frontline therapy, I first think to myself, do they have any actionable targets? Because sometimes some of these oral therapies are better tolerated than triplet therapy with gemcitabine, cisplatin plus IO. If they don't have any targets, then certainly if I can do gemcitabine alone, if that's all they can tolerate, if they can tolerate the gemcitabine cisplatin doublet, then I do all three as a combination.
So, you know, our way of doing consensus is if everybody, we ask people what they do in their practice, if they all say the same thing, we call it a consensus. Second line therapy over here, I see six different answers with six different people. So I would not call that a consensus. But I'm curious, I like the idea of, I'm interested, you're the only one who picked Cape Sidebeam Mill in second line, which kind of makes sense. Any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, in SWOG, we did a study, a second line with capecitabine versus a MEK inhibitor. My friend Richard Kim did that study. And of course, it was a randomized study. And it was a negative study for the MEK inhibitor, which was a study arm. But curiously, the control arm, capecitabine, when you look at the progression-free survival, overall survival, it was really no different from what we see from the other trials. Of course, it was not a randomized trial comparing FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, but it had similar figures, you know, with about 3 months PFS, overall survival approaching, say, 7 months. So I wonder if we really need doublets or we follow the paradigm, say, in breast cancer, you know, where you think of a single agent with reasonable efficacy. So I do use single agent capecitabine. A cautionary note is older patients have impaired renal clearance, so you have to be just cautious about the dose of capecitabine.
So we're going to move on now and talk about targeted treatment. And I wanted to start with this graphic, Lippy, that you showed in your presentation. Can you comment a little, kind of provide an overview of the potential targets right now that we have with these diseases?
Yeah, so as Milan mentioned, there are three different biliary tract cancers. There's intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, and gallbladder cancer. And within extrahepatic, there's perihilar and distal. For intrahepatic cholangio, about 40% to 50% of tumors harbor some sort of actionable target. In extrahepatic cholangio, I would say it's about 10 to 20%. And in gallbladder cancer, it's also about 20 to 25%. This graphic in particular is intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And the main targets are FGFR2 fusions, IDH1 mutations, which are the two most common. And then we see some of these other targets, HER2, NTRK, BRAF, mismatch repair deficiency. And this was what it looked like in 2020. And then just in 2023, the team from Art Vogel's group published another article. And you can see that we're now expanding targets. We now have MDM2 amplification as well. We're seeing FGFR2 mutations also be sensitive to therapies. We're seeing BRCA1 and BRCA2. We're using PARP inhibitors and some other drugs against patients that have DNA damage repair pathway alterations. So with more study of these tumors and more drug development, we're identifying new matches between patients and drugs.
And here are a couple, I'm just going to show you some of the slides in these. This is a great one. It, you know, breaks it down based on the specifics there. And here's another one. But one thing, when you were presenting, you presented a case to me, Milland, of a patient with a BRCA, I think it was a BRCA2 somatic mutation. And one of the things that you comment, maybe you can comment on how often you see this, but one of the things you mentioned that I thought was really interesting was they respond better to platinum, which of course you see in all cancers, but I kind of didn't think about that. Have you ever used the PARP inhibitor, Milland, in a patient with BTC?
Definitely. Actually, the case that I was showing you at that time was a person who with gallbladder cancer with somatic BRCA, who had a remarkable response to Gemcitabine and Pembro, Gemcitabine and Durvalumab. And even we believe in that tail in the curve was enriched with patients with DNA damage repair mutations with Durvalumab. So yes, we have treated patients with Olaparib. There's an ongoing trial through a crew group, which is showing some satisfactory results. So certainly I see a situation analogous to pancreas cancer where some patients might benefit from, say, maintenance PARP inhibition, perhaps after systemic therapy with GemCis. That type of an approach, I think, should be considered.
So, Lipica, of course, one of the issues is what kind of workup to do on the patient. Some you were mentioning the perihilar disease where sometimes you can't even get a biopsy. Can you comment a little bit about the approach to trying to pick up mutations, what the limitations are, particularly in things like FGFR, and where a liquid biopsy fits in?
You know, my general approach when I see patients is they walk into my office and I say, "Hi, I'm Dr. Goyle. Let's profile your tumor." because I think it's really important to profile tumors early. Because as you said, there's an up to 25% failure rate when you try to sequence biopsies in cholangiocarcinoma, especially in extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma where you have brushings or FNAs, but there's a high failure rate. And so we want to know early if we're going to need to do a repeat biopsy or in the interim if we can do a liquid biopsy. So there's a variety of excellent next-generation sequencing assays. It's important, as you were mentioning, because there are FGFR2 fusions, to use an assay that has good sequencing to pick up fusions. Often RNA-based sequencing can pick these up with a good degree of sensitivity. Liquid biopsies are showing a lot of promise in biliary tract cancer as well, and they have good sensitivity for the vast majority of mutations compared to tissue-based biopsies, tissue-based analysis, except for FGFR2 fusions. We did a study where Dr. Javle also collaborated, where we were looking at over 1,700 patients who got Guardant's 360 assay. And we found that when you looked at FGFR2 fusions, the assay was picking up 18% of the fusions that we were seeing on tissue. And so they've now improved their bioinformatics pipeline to be able to detect the fusions better. And there are a series of other liquid biopsy platforms. It's really important to know your sequencing platform to know, are you going to be able to pick up what you're looking for? But yes, in biliary tract cancers, given there's so many targeted therapies available now, really important to target early, to sequence early.
Yeah, the fusion story people have heard a lot about through lung cancer. Anything you want to add to that, Milind? And also, we've already gotten through half this webinar. Nobody in the chat room said, what about cell-free DNA? I'll say it then. Any interest in cell-free DNA and anything else you want to add to what Lipika said?
So, yes, I mean, I think you pointed it out. Cell-free DNA is becoming a great tool in colorectal cancer. And I have been anecdotally using it in biliary tract cancer as well for patients who undergo surgical resection. I think it's something we're going to see more of, especially for diseases like extrahepatic cholangio, perihilar cholangio, even in the advanced, in the locally advanced setting, where the disease volume is hard to measure on radiology. Perhaps we need another tool, such as quantitative DNA analysis in the blood. Our group has been trying to develop an assay using biliary cytology, and I think that we're going to see some of that come up as well, just because now even KRAS seems to be a gene that we may be able to hit in the near future. So clearly, we need to find all the tools possible, use all the tools possible in order to get a better, more informative NGS.
So let's talk about HER2. I feel like I'm talking about that every day, no matter what cancer type other than the hematologic cancers. I wonder whether or not T-DXd is going to end up getting a pan-tumor approval, but we'll see what happens. So let's just talk a little bit about HER2 and biliary tract cancers. And this is one thing that really shocked me. I guess it was the work you did, Milind, looking at a group of patients in terms of HER2, finding very high expression of HER2 with gallbladder cancer, I think 50%. Am I reading that right?
Yes. So I credit this work to Dr. Ivan Roa from Chile. He's really one of those old-fashioned pathologists who lovingly dissected tissue, spent really hours and hours looking at over 100 patients with surgically resected gallbladder cancer from Chile, a country where this disease is endemic. So the majority of patients with gallbladder cancer have HER2 expression, almost 55%. But if you look at HER2 3 plus expression, it's about 15%, and an equal distribution of HER2 2 plus and 1 plus. Then this was in surgically resected patients, at least. We couldn't replicate what we see in gall in breast cancer, and that is prognostic value of HER2 was not the case here. HER2 high or low had a similar type of survival. But this showed that HER2 is a target. And at that time, the study was done over a decade ago, really not much interest. All we had was trastuzumab. But now this field, as I have no doubt you will discuss later, has had a resurgence with several new targeted therapies. One of the first in this setting was the My Pathway study, which I ran with my colleague, Dr. Merrick Bernstam, which showed that with trastuzumab and pertuzumab, this was a study done in patients who had received a median of one prior line of therapy, but several patients had two and three prior lines of therapy. The overall response rate was 23%, but these were deep responses for as long as 8 months. And patients responded, the tolerance of this therapy was excellent. So again, this was in HER2 new amplified BTC or 3+ positive with IHC. The most remarkable, another remarkable drug that was investigated in a phase one study was the bispecific antibody zanidatamab, which targets the trastuzumab binding domain and the pertuzumab binding domain. And in a phase one study, which again was included a large percentage of biliary tract cancer, again, secondary to my colleague and friend, Dr. Merrick, who allowed my biliary patients to enroll on the study, the response was a very, very, very impressive 40% deep responses, which led to a pivotal trial, the Horizon BTC01 trial, read by Dr. Pant, which was a worldwide trial of close to 100 patients. And this showed this, as you can see from the waterfall plot, these patients enrolled on the trial were all kinds of biliary tract cancer, but really the yellow, the majority of the patients that did well were gallbladder cancer patients. Patients enrolled on this trial typically had 3+ or 2+ and FISH positive disease. So this showed that this therapy worked, and over 45% of patients had responded, but the duration of response was a very staggering 1 year. So this showed that there was really a proof of concept that a specific inhibitor could be effective. And at ASCO this year, we saw very nice data with tucatinib and trastuzumab building on the Mountaineer trial, which was in colorectal cancer with HER2 amplification. So this study, which was a relatively smaller study, but showed, again, a very impressive response, where 45% of patients responded. The duration of response was also very good at close to 7 months. The combination was well tolerated. So this is another possible option for these patients. The time to response was 2 months, which basically at the first scan, and again, a very impressive response of over 6 months. So these drugs were used in the highly pre-treated population, so in the second and third line. Of course, the trastuzumab deruxtecan is a antibody drug conjugate, which uses topoisomerase 1 inhibitor along with trastuzumab, along with the linker. This has been investigated in a variety of tumors in the DESTINY trial. These data were also presented at ASCO 2023, and it showed efficacy in all kinds of cancers. Unfortunately, not so much in pancreas cancer, which is also a KRAS mutated tumor, which we believe is a mechanism of resistance. But right in the center, in the purple bars that you see there, is biliary tract cancer, a very impressive response seen in patients who had HER2 3+ expression. So now we have several drugs which are approved in this, which have a potential in this setting. Some of them, like trastuzumab, pertuzumab, has made it in the NCCN guidelines, and some others we hope will have FDA approval or NCCN guidelines very soon. These are some of the toxicities seen here with the DESTINY pan-tumor trial, which are typically, the drug is well tolerated, but it has a chemotherapy backbone. So you do have GI toxicity. We do have myelosuppression. And with long-term usage, there is a risk of pulmonary fibrosis, which needs to be followed on imaging. This is an investigator-initiated HERB-BEAST trial in patients with HER-expressing biliary tract cancer, which it was an investigator-initiated trial, which really showed similar findings. Patients who were enrolled on this trial were, again, 3+ or 2+ and positive by ISH. And you can see that 36% of patients responded. The median progression-free survival and 6-month progression-free survival paralleled what you see with these effective agents, other agents that we're seeing. Interestingly, there were some patients in this trial who had received prior HER2-based therapies. In terms of HER2 low-expressing disease, both in the DESTINY trial as well as the HER-B trial, responses were not seen, like in HER2 2+, unlike what you see in breast cancer and some other diseases. So I think this has to be looked into further what happens in HER2 plus and ISH positive, or is it are there other mechanisms of resistance in play? I suspect there are just not enough patients with HER2 plus enrolled in these trials, and we would learn with additional experience. So some of the toxicities are described here. These agents are these are ADCs, so you have myelosuppression and you have interstitial lung fibrosis seen. I mean, the number listed here is 12%, which is kind of high, but it's certainly it was a small study, the HERB study. But this it depends often on the duration of therapy. As you get beyond 6 months with trastuzumab deruxtecan, there's a higher risk of pulmonary fibrosis. So this has to be carefully followed, both on with clinical history as well as high-resolution CT imaging of the chest.
So there's a lot there to think about, a lot of different strategies. You know, T-DXd, of course, you know, we're talking about, we've already, obviously, breast cancer, lung cancer, but lung cancer, HER2 mutant, upper GI cancer, colorectal cancer, biliary tract cancer. Lippy, any thoughts about whether or not T-DXd is going to end up with a pan-tumor approval?
Yeah, the data are certainly promising, so it'll be up to the FDA about what they think, but we're encouraged to see activity across multiple tumor types, certainly.
Any thoughts about supportive care for patients getting T-DXd? Lippy, of course, again, we talk about it in all these other, and breast cancer has, I guess, the most experience, but both acute and, of course, interstitial lung disease that Millen just referred to. It is considered an emetogenic, highly emetogenic regimen that requires pre-medication. And I know, actually, you haven't actually used this, Lippy, but I imagine it's going to be happening once you are able to. Any thoughts about the issue in terms of supportive care? And also, what are you going to do in terms of screening for ILD and management of patients who develop, for example, asymptomatic issues on their chest imaging?
Yeah, great questions. You know, as you can see on this slide, the any grade nausea was around 40%, but the grade 3 nausea was 0% with this treatment. So, you know, luckily we're used to managing nausea with different chemotherapy agents. So I think the pre-medication certainly can be helpful for T-DXd. For the interstitial lung disease, as Millen was mentioning, following these patients closely with CT scans, high-resolution CT scans to pick it up. You know, we've been seeing interstitial lung-related issues with gemcitabine over the years. So we are used to actually picking this up and managing it. Anytime someone on gemcitabine comes in with shortness of breath, it's always on our differential. And so same thing with this drug, especially as people get more further into treatment and on it for longer. Anyone coming in with shortness of breath or dry cough, you know, along with COVID, we also think about interstitial lung disease for these patients.
And of course, the other issue is going to be preemptive CT imaging, Millen. You know, breast cancer, they're pretty, we're getting ready, as you heard, we're going to be talking about this next week in San Antonio. And breast cancer, they're pretty aggressive about pulmonary imaging. We'll do it, you know, regularly, even if they're not going to get an image for their metastatic disease. How are you thinking you're going to approach this, Millen? And in general, where do you see it fitting in? This is from the survey we did. I think people are thinking about anti-HER therapy right now, second line. But can you comment on what you're going to be thinking about or doing in terms of imaging, looking for ILD, Millen? And what's going to be your second line therapy? You say, again, trastuzumab, pertuzumab. Other people say Zani or T-DXd.
So fortunately, unlike our breast cancer colleagues, we generally obtain CAT scans of chest, abdomen, and pelvis for restaging pretty routinely in biliary tract cancer because lung metastases are very common. And so we do, in the few patients that I've treated with this agent, you do find pulmonary fibrosis changes or develop in the asymptomatic setting. So you follow the company guideline on following the, in terms of the clinical trial guideline, if the asymptomatic minimal changes on CT, they can be continued. But once they get asymptomatic or progressive, the drug has to be discontinued. And I have unfortunately seen some pretty serious effects with this drug. So I think there's going to be a learning curve, and we look forward to guidance when the drug is approved in this setting in terms of how it should be managed. In terms of lines of therapy, currently all of these drugs are being developed in the refractory space. I certainly think there is a good indication, if they're HER2 positive, that these agents can move up front. But in the second line space, I'm hoping that we are able to use many or all of them or in some sort of a sequential way. So I'm going to look closely and see which drug, which of these has effectiveness in the refractory setting, which can be used second line, which of them is more potent than the others. And I'm already sort of beginning to see which of these might have a better response. So I think these will, without, you know, giving too much without reading too much into single arm trials, I would say we can all make our decisions based on response rates to the individual trials, the likelihood of them being effective in the second line setting, and that will help us determine the line of therapy.
And it's always challenging to come up with these cases to see how people will respond. I never know what to put 80 or 85 or how much comorbidity, but I'm trying to kind of see whether or not I can get people thinking about maybe less toxic therapy first line. And Lippy, we say 80-year-old use. You say you might want to use something like Zani. What are you thinking?
Yeah, given you said that regulatory and reimbursement issues aside, I went with what I thought would be a great idea, a great regimen for this patient, in that it's a well-tolerated drug, and we know that only 40% of patients get to Plan B. So if I'm only going to get one shot potentially, I want to try to use something that's relatively well-tolerated and has a good response rate. Of course, the long-term survivors, we're seeing, you know, several of those with pembrolizumab and durvalumab. But even with zanidatamab, some patients are on it for 2 or 3 years. So I think in an 80-year-old, of course, it depends on the performance status and an informed conversation with the patient, but I would certainly consider Zani up front.
And we presented a HER2-low. As mentioned, we're doing an entire symposium next week on HER2-low. But it looks like most people are not ready to buy into that for biliary tract, except Dr. Kelly, who said she would think about TDXD. Maybe she's seen people respond in that situation. We also asked whether or not, based on what you know, are people ready to use Zani? And a number of people, including both of you, say, yeah, you'd like to be able to use it. We asked also about tucatinib, you know, the Mountaineer regimen, whether or not the faculty would like to use that. And Milind, you brought that up. I know CNS mets are not that common in biliary tract, but that's a big rationale, of course, in breast cancer. And then we asked in terms of TDXD for people to make estimates of what the likelihood is that the patient would have to have the dose held or treatment held. And, you know, it's interesting, Dr. Abu Alfa was saying he needs more experience. I think the entire field, you guys haven't really had the chance to use the drug yet, so it'll be interesting. Lippy, can you comment a little bit about if you were able to access TDXD, or maybe you could right now, when you would use it, in what line of therapy?
You know, certainly the data are encouraging. So if I had a patient who got first-line gemcitabine cisplatin plus IO and then went on to something like trastuzumab FOLFOX, can certainly think about trastuzumab deruxtecan third line.
Interesting. All right, let's talk about FGFR inhibitors. We have two, pemigatinib and futibatinib. We did have infigratinib, but that's no longer available. Milind, can you kind of talk a little bit about your vision about what FGFR alterations and fusions are and how these agents are therapeutic?
So I think the FGFR story has been transformative, not just for cholangio, but also just for the whole field of targeted therapy. It has shown us the value of sequential biopsies, the value of targeting resistant mutations, as Lippy herself has very elegantly showed, that, you know, you can use a reversible FGFR inhibitor. You can find resistant mutations that come up, and that can be hit subsequently by a covalent inhibitor. So that's sort of what I use in practice now. I use pemigatinib type therapy, and then if they get, say, a resistant mutation, second line, I use futibatinib. I think futibatinib is the more powerful drug. It has a higher response rate. So certainly a case can be made using that front line, and then subsequently considering a clinical trial second line. So ultimately, sort of like most of the situations in oncology, we want patients to have exposure to as many effective drugs that are available in a sequential manner. And I think we are learning from these new drugs that are being developed in the FGFR space.
So, Lippy, on the other issue here, or another issue, as is often the case with targeted therapy, that even though it's oral, there are significant tolerability issues. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what you see with these agents?
Sure. The drugs that Milind was just talking about, pemigatinib and futibatinib, these are pan-FGFR inhibitors. So pemigatinib hits FGFR 1 through 3 and a little bit less potent against FGFR4, and futibatinib is potent against FGFR 1 through 4. So we're trying to hit FGFR2, but because these drugs also hit FGFR1 as an on-target, off-tumor effect, we see hyperphosphatemia. And so this is seen in about 60 to 80% of patients that go on FGFR inhibitors. And so it's important to, when you're checking regular labs, to check phosphorus level. And then we have a series of interventions that we can do, such as using phosphorus binders, using phosphaturics, where people can urinate out phosphorus to help manage the hyperphosphatemia, you know, using hydration, helping make sure people are not constipated. All of those things treat hyperphosphatemia. We also see some nail changes where people can get onycholysis, loss of their nails. And you can see here, people also get some eye toxicities, such as retinal detachment or central serous retinopathy, where you get some fluid behind the retina. Usually this is grade 1, grade 2. People can see some floaters, some flashing lights, and usually with stopping drug, and you know, we often send them to ophthalmology to check on them. But usually with stopping drug, you can restart after a week, sometimes at the same dose, sometimes at one dose lower, depending on how severe the symptoms and how long they lasted. The other thing we see is hand-foot syndrome. We're all used to managing this with capecitabine and also with tyrosine kinase inhibitors that we give. Key is to intervene early, use the different kinds of urea creams, and help people have really greasy hands and feet before they go to bed. And usually it's manageable, but sometimes it's grade 3 and sometimes we have to hold and stop the drug.
Milind, can you comment on your experience? These are photographs that you actually had in your presentation with these agents, and how tolerable or not tolerable they are.
So certainly they're a lot more tolerable than chemotherapy, which we are used to doing. But as you can see from the figures here on the nail, the patient described it to me as, imagine you can't touch anything without pain. And that's how I feel. And unfortunately, all the treatments that Lippy described are what we use. None of them are terribly effective. So we don't really have great treatment for onychomedesis or lysis of nails. We have to cut them in a proper way, soak them, that sort of thing. For hand-foot syndrome, we do have some lotions, etc. But really, the best way to manage it is withhold the drug or lower the dose. I think of all of this, the easiest perhaps to manage is the ocular. You can withhold it even for a week, and you often see reversal of the ocular effects. They just need very close monitoring. So these effects are, and then you do have diarrhea, you do have arthralgias, body aches. These are quite consistent and not minor. I think through experience, we learn to manage them all.
I think the key is that these drugs are effective. And as Milind is saying, with experience, we've learned to manage them. And, you know, prolonged grade 2 toxicities that last for many months are such a big hit on people's quality of life. So the key is that since they're so effective, that we really need to be proactive about intervening. And so we can keep people on these drugs longer. Because also, as Milind was mentioning, people can develop resistance if we're holding the drug too long, if we're decreasing the dose too much. So to keep up dose density and intensity, it really makes a big difference to manage these symptoms proactively.
So going back to our survey, we can see, again, a little bit of a heterogeneity in terms of choice, but everybody's at this point saying second line, futibatinib a little bit more common than pemigatinib, although I guess one of the potential rationales would be that you can give futibatinib after pemigatinib. Is that why you use pemigatinib first, Milind?
Basically, yes. I mean, we do have we have trials and offer refractory agent, and in that setting, futibatinib is perfectly appropriate. And I don't think that rationale alone is adequate, because there are other mechanisms of resistance besides the ones that futibatinib can target. So I think futibatinib first line is perfectly appropriate.
So here's another attempt to see whether I can get anybody who want to use first line targeted therapy. And I got a couple people, you, Lippi, and Dr. Kelly, are saying in an 80-year-old patient, you might think about FGFR first. Maybe in clinical trial it'd be even better, but that would be another possibility to consider. Here are the numbers that people gave when we said, what's the likelihood of holding the drug? You can see a lot of differences in experience, but similarities between pemigatinib and futibatinib in terms of the numbers that people give. Milan, can you comment a little bit about, speaking of pan-tumor approvals, the use of BRAF inhibitors, specifically dab-trem? That's a pretty nice-looking waterfall plot. What's your experience, Milan?
So this is, I think, one of our successes in cholangio, something we never really expected. This was, again, the My Pathway study, where a variety of tumors were allowed to be enrolled with BRAF V600E mutation, and they allowed some biliary, and we enrolled some patients, and we were shocked. People really did well. So the duration of response here was 8 months, and I have patients in my practice on these therapies for now over 2 years. So it's almost like melanoma. So this is certainly, unfortunately, there's only 5 to 7%, and that too in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. So these are patients who do really well, and I hope today, this day and age, no one with BRAF V600E mutation is denied access to these therapies.
So returning to the question of line of therapy in a younger patient, most of the faculty says IO chemo, except, of course, Dr. Abu Alpha may be wanting to be a little provocative. And, in lung cancer, that's what they do,
yes,
we have obviously
yes.
a lot more experience. But, you got a 60% response rate. You're getting it first line in lung cancer. But then again, we bump up to age 80, and now Lippi's coming on board again. What's your experience in terms of tolerability? We hear, different stories about fevers, et cetera. Lippi, what do you actually see?
Yeah, some fever, some rash, some diarrhea. Those are the main things that we're seeing with it, some GI side effects. But overall, people with proactive management, we can get people through it.
So let's finish out. We could talk about MSI high, which you occasionally see in biliary tract cancers, and NTRK. But we'll finish out with another common mutation, IDH. Here's IDH1, but of course IDH2 as well. Milan, would you like to take a shot at explaining sort of the pathophysiology of why we what happens with these cancers that are in AML? It's kind of a similar pathophysiology.
Yeah, fortunately, the finding that IDH mutations, IDH1, R132, occur in about 20% of the time in intrahepatic cholangio. This, we found out about this around the same time that ivosidenib was already being used for AML. So it was serendipity that we had a drug and we had a mutation. So this led to a trial in the second line space. So IDH1 mutation, of course, the audience would remember from the Krebs cycle from medical school, results in the alteration of the metabolite with less 2-ketoglucarate and increase in hydroxyglucarate, and that can be actually measured in the blood. So that leads to epigenetic alteration, oncogenesis. So this can be targeted with a specific small molecule inhibitor described here as ivosidenib. Now, this drug was approved based on the CLARITY trial, which was a second-line trial where patients who had received prior GemCis were either offered the study drug versus placebo and a crossover, because this was conducted at a time when even the FOLFOX data were not out, so placebo was considered reasonable. And I think the previous slide showed that the progression-free survival was not that remarkable. So my fellows tell me that it was 1.4 months versus 2.7 months. And do you call this a success? But really, the success is the tail in the curve, where you see 15% of patients who do well at the end of 1 year. And I saw a patient yesterday in my practice doing wonderful with malignant ascites, now feeling much where you got out 6 months into the course, and at the expense, I might say, of really few toxicities. So this drug is very well tolerated, and quality of life has been studied as a secondary endpoint in the study. And I find sometimes in my practice, people are loath to discontinue the drug even when they are progressing, because they just feel good on this drug. So it is certainly... I think the success is underscored by the progression-free survival. This is an effective therapy to use in the refractory setting.
And yeah, that's exactly where people are using it. Although, again, when we bump up to, well, and we bump up to age 80, I guess it's not convincing enough to bring it into first line. Anything you want to add to that, Lippy, in terms of quality of life? Any? I don't hear anything about that with AML. Have you? Other than hematologic issues, any tolerability issues, and any situations where you wouldn't want to use it first line?
No, I think as Milan said, it's a very well-tolerated drug, and that's why a placebo-controlled trial was successful, because we didn't know if people were on the drug or on placebo. But overall, very well-tolerated. Some QTC prolongation, some nausea, GI side effects, but for the most part, we can get people through it.
So, Lippy and Milan, thank you so much for working with us on this project. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back next week. We got lots and lots of stuff going on in San Antonio and San Diego with ASH. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Lippy. Thanks a lot, Milan.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Thank you.